Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of The Negotiation. In this episode, I sit down with Joe Mazur, senior analyst at Trivium China, a research firm specializing in China's politics and economy. Based in Beijing and with his finger on the pulse of U.S.-China relations, Joe provides valuable insights into the current state of the bilateral relationship as well as the economic landscape in China. Joe begins by discussing the latest tariffs imposed by the U.S. on China, placing them within the context of recent trade actions and the broader trade relationship between the two superpowers. He explores the potential implications of future U.S. presidential administrations, pondering the effects of a second Trump versus a second Biden term on U.S.-China policy and U.S.-China relations. The conversation then shifts to practical advice for foreign companies operating in or considering entering the Chinese market. Joe outlines strategies to mitigate geopolitical risks over the next couple of years, additionally reflecting on the outcomes of Secretary of State Anthony Blinken's recent visit to China. Joe also delves into the state of China's economic recovery post-pandemic and points out some of the positive indicators that might signal a turnaround. Enjoy.
So in terms of what to expect, first of all, yeah, the U.S.-China tension is not going anywhere, right? I think no matter who's in office, we're going to see an expansion of tariffs. You know, one thing to keep in mind is that, you know, well, so far, China has been relatively circumspect about not responding in kind with tariffs, right? It's sort of basically, you know, the MO has been to, for the most part, just kind of rant and rail about American protectionism and economic suppression, but then either opt to not do anything or to do a mostly symbolic response.
Home to over 4 billion people, the Asia-Pacific region boasts one of the most powerful consumer markets on the planet. Not only is it home to half of the world's under 30 population, but it's also home to more than half the world's internet users. It's a market that no globally minded organization should ignore. But entering markets like China, Japan, or Southeast Asia is no easy task. Just ask the likes of Microsoft, Google, Uber, and Facebook. However, times are changing, and with the right partners, doors are slowly opening as more and more companies find success growing their key markets in APAC. I myself spent 8 years in China, mostly as a venture capitalist, helping early-stage tech companies grow in the Asia-Pacific market successfully. This show is dedicated to uncovering and examining successful Asia market entry and growth strategies by interviewing the experts who've done it before and truly understand what it takes to be successful in the region. My name is Todd Embley, and welcome to The Negotiation, brought to you by WPIC Marketing and Technologies. Joe, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. Good to be here.
Why don't we start with where you are in the world today, where we're recording you from?
I am here in Beijing. It's a very beautiful May day. And yeah, the weather is really nice today. So it's a good time to be in Beijing.
I think, you know, the May and the September, October, always amazing.
It's the incredibly short spring window before it gets very, very hot. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Tell us a little bit about how you ended up in China.
Yeah, well, it's a pretty, I think, classic foreigner in China story in some ways. You know, after high school, I did a gap year. And I went backpacking in Asia, as you know, a lot of young folks from you know, certain parts of the world do. And yeah, I went to a number of countries, but China really stuck with me. I spent about 6 weeks just traveling across the country, mostly by kind of sleeper trains. And yeah, I knew absolutely nothing about China before I came, spoke not a word of Chinese apart from ni hao and xie xie. And just, I really had an incredible experience. It was like no place I'd ever been. And this was 2010. So this was sort of in the warm afterglow of the 2008 Olympics. So after I returned home, you know, I'd been to a number of countries and I'd enjoyed, you know, most of them. But China was the one that really kind of stuck with me as a place that was worth understanding and was interesting. You know, so I went to undergrad, to university, did a number of China-related programs. I did like a language study 1 year. I did my thesis research in Hong Kong. And just sort of for lack of a better option, when I was about to graduate, I saw that there was a free master's program out of Peking University. And I thought, yeah, free master's degree in China sounds great. And so, yeah, that was the first cohort of the Yenching Academy program, which now is just celebrated its 10th anniversary. And yeah, I've been in China ever since. So, yeah, I joined Trivium about 5 years ago, and you know, learned a lot about Chinese politics and geopolitics and the economy. And it's a very, very exciting place to be, and grateful for the opportunities I've had.
Okay, quick question. How well did the education you got in the U.S. about China, how accurate was it? How useful was it? How well did they do?
Yeah, I mean, I think the education, because I was a history major, and so kind of a lot of my focus ended up being on Chinese history. And I don't think any of it was wrong per se, but I think it's you know, as ever with China, only part of the story, right? Like having the kind of, in particular, the historical and the language background was really useful. But there's obviously kind of so much more to learn by living in the country and being here. And I think language is maybe the prime example of that. Is I took Chinese for 4 years in college and thought, okay, I have a pretty decent understanding of the language, but you know, it really didn't survive contact with the first meeting with a Beijing cab driver when he's dropping the R's and the N's. And so, you know, and that's another example of something that, you know, language acquisition, you just sort of kind of have to be in the country. You know, it's obviously good to have a base and understand the grammar principles and to do the book learning. But part of you just has to be there and put in the time and make the mistakes and learn by doing.
Which is North specific as well, because if you go to Shanghai, you drop it. It's Fuyen, not Fuyar.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I still can't really replicate the Beijing accent. I can understand it, but and then if you go to certain parts of the South, then you know my Mandarin doesn't really avail me in terms of being able to understand what folks are saying. So it's a perpetual learning process, which I think is one of the things that makes living and working in China very exciting, is you're always learning something you didn't know the day before.
Yeah. I think if you study history in a country about another country, and then you end up going to that country, that's when you first realize that history is not fact, it is perspective. That is like the nicest way that I could say it. All right, let's dive right into this. Give us an update on the latest tariffs that the U.S. imposed on China. Maybe give us some context of where that falls in other recent trade actions from the last several months, and just some insight on the broader trade relationship in general.
Yeah, so I mean, I guess I'll kind of go back a little bit before addressing the most recent things. It's anybody who's been following the news even remotely knows that it's been a very challenging time in U.S.-China relations, and a lot of that has to do with the economic relationship. We began to see the beginnings of a thaw in 2023. That was kind of, as far as we can tell, meant to be kicked off in early 2023. And then there was the balloon gate incident, which kind of forced the Biden administration to kind of hold fire on making nice overtures until that had kind of blown over. But then beginning that summer, we saw a number of high level visits by top U.S. officials, and kind of the efforts to reestablish guardrails around the relationship, right? And if not to materially improve the relationship, then to at least put a floor under it, right? So we don't want it to spiral completely out of control. And that kind of culminated last November with the summit between Xi Jinping and Joe Biden at APEC in San Francisco. I think at first we were slightly, going into that meeting, my team and I were a little bit apprehensive, because we had seen summits like this before. Everyone says kind of all the right things about managing competition and cooperation, but then, you know, it kind of falls apart immediately. This was kind of different. We had a number of pretty concrete deliverables. We had an agreement by both sides to restart military-to-military communication, which is obviously very important from the perspective of, you know, avoiding misunderstandings when it comes to issues like Taiwan. We had cooperation on fentanyl, right? And just kind of a number of steps that really convinced us that this was more than just kind of the standard, you know, boilerplate, we should responsibly manage the competition. So that persisted for, you know, a few months. And then we saw kind of an uptick in what the Chinese side would call U.S. economic suppression, and what the U.S. side would call, you know, defending our core interests and our domestic industry and whatnot. So that'll be things like obviously the TikTok ban. That'll be sort of this latest round of tariffs on Chinese NEVs, steel, those kind of things. The Chinese side is clearly frustrated, right? They're saying, okay, well, you said all these things at APEC and sort of in the intervening months about how there needs to be more cooperation. And then you kind of go after some of our industries and you're making these complaints about overcapacity, which they've kind of rejected. I think that there's a number of factors at play here, which maybe we can get into in a second. But I think we're seeing kind of the natural ebb and flow of U.S.-China relations, and that you'll have a period of thawing and then a period of kind of retrenchment. I think that that's kind of where we are right now. And the tariffs are just sort of another step along the way.
Tariffs are just they're a tool. Right.
Yeah.
It's just you whack me, I whack you. It's a stick on the playground. A couple of things in there. One, love what you did there. You said the balloon incident blowing over. I like that. But I want to remind you that the host is only the only one allowed to do puns. OK, just.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm really sorry about that. Yeah,
it's OK. It's OK. I'm sure we'll get through that. The other thing was. Ban on TikTok. Is it a ban or is it a forced sale?
It's a good question. I mean, so effectively, it amounts to a ban in so much as the Chinese leadership has been pretty clear that it will not allow a divestment. And this kind of allows the U.S. an out to say, oh, we're not forcing you to, we're not banning TikTok. We're giving you the option to sell it. I think knowing full well that that's incredibly unlikely to happen. It's a bit of a semantics argument in my opinion. But I think it's pretty clear, like the Chinese leadership has been pretty clear that they're not willing to see it divested, and they know that the U.S. knows that. So yeah, I mean, it's in China's book, it's another instance of U.S. economic suppression. The U.S. of course is making the argument that this is a step we need to take to protect our networks, to protect the data of American citizens, and to protect, and to be mindful of the kind of content that, China may or may not be able to influence on social media platforms. So
we've seen this postulating multiple times. I mean, go back to when Microsoft tried to enter and Google tried to enter into China. And it's just like, you want locally hosted, owned, run platforms where you've got all the, it's an attention economy, right? And so where you have that, and then you're able to measure and potentially, yes, manipulate or what have you. But
right.
Okay, let's talk about the U.S. politics for a sec. And if you don't mind, could you, with your crystal ball that we know is always 100% spot on, maybe talk about the second Trump administration versus a second Biden administration and what each of those might mean and the impact it would have on the relationship with China or China policy?
Yeah, it's a great question. Oh, one thing, while we're talking about electioneering, I think one point I'd also like to make about the tariffs is that, I think that they were calculated by the Biden administration for maximum political effect, right? When you look at the things that are being tariffed, right? It's things like things related to shipbuilding, steel, aluminum, and it seems to be, I don't want to use the term pandering, but it seems to be targeted to generate momentum among really important industries and unions in the U.S., right?
So I think, of course, it's sentiment analysis. And then, if we did something like this, we might be able to gain a percent out of this crowd.
Yeah.
And so,
the fact
it's a weigh your options and then,
Yeah, the fact that Biden first kind of floated the idea for these tariffs, these steel tariffs in Pennsylvania, like, I mean, okay, you know, yeah, I mean, I don't want to, you know, I think there is a legitimate concern for the Biden administration about protecting American industry for its own sake. But, you know, there's obviously also a political dimension. But to your question about what does a Trump versus a Biden administration mean for China, I think to answer this question, it makes sense to look at the picture from China's perspective. And I think that China sees a choice between sort of the devil you know in Biden and, you know, the wild card in Trump. So, and I don't think either option is particularly appealing from Beijing's perspective. So if Biden wins a second term, you're looking at somebody who's kind of a steadier hand, but one that's not necessarily any softer on China, right? So I think that there was a moment, I mean, you know, when Trump was exiting the White House in 2021, there was, I think, a sigh of relief in China thinking, okay, well, that, you know, that was the guy who precipitated the trade war. You know, he blamed us for COVID. And now I think that there was an assumption that the Biden administration would be sort of like the third Obama administration, right? It would just sort of be a return to
what it was. Yeah.
And I think that there was a moment of bitter disappointment, or maybe several moments of bitter disappointment in Beijing when they realized that, if anything, Biden was arguably tougher on China than Trump was. I mean, he kept most of the Trump-era tariffs in place. His econ restrictions were kind of a lot more targeted, whereas Trump would kind of, you know, in some cases just flail around and lash out at certain industries or companies. The Biden administration was a lot more about kind of designing economic restrictions for maximum impact, you know, not least the chip ban. And I think possibly worst of all, Biden is a very traditional allies and partners guy. Right. So he was able to kind of rebuild a lot of American relationships elsewhere in the world and marshal together a pretty strong anti-China coalition, or if not anti-China, then at least a Sino-skeptic coalition, you know, in Europe, in Asia Pacific. And so that's something I think that kind of prompted a change in Chinese diplomacy, because prior to that, this was sort of the high watermark of wolf warrior diplomacy, which I think that leaders in China began to realize, this is not very counterproductive, or this is not very productive. And this, if anything, is kind of, you know, making the case for countries to kind of re-enter the U.S. orbit following the America First policy of the Trump administration. So much I'd say is that, you know, there are bright sides for a Biden presidency from China's perspective, right? In the sense that he is open to dialogue. Like I said, there is he does place a premium on putting guardrails around the relationship, so at least they're not devolving into kind of outright conflict, which is something. But you know, it's, if Biden is reelected, it's probably going to be more of the same for China, which is pretty pointed American pressure, which is then kind of expanded globally, you know, as the U.S. pressures its allies and partners to take a similar line on China to the one that they're taking, right? So you can also assume that there's going to be a baseline level of dialogue, but it's not going to, China won't, in my opinion, be any closer to getting what it wants in terms of getting the U.S. to lay off its economic restrictions or its overall pressure on China if Biden is reelected. So I think those are the pros and cons of a Biden administration for China. Trump is kind of the inverse of that, right? He's very unpredictable. He's already made some comments that I think are certainly going to be worrying Beijing, that he's going to impose like 60% tariffs across the board on Chinese goods. You know, who knows if he's going to actually follow through with that. A lot of the people who may be in Trump's inner circle during a hypothetical second term are very serious China hawks, advocating, you know, competition up to and including regime change. So yeah, I mean that there, and also Trump is known to be very capricious, right? He could just sort of relaunch the trade war in earnest, He could take aim at a number of important Chinese industries. So that's obviously very worrying. On the other hand, I think that there are a number of possible silver linings if Trump gets elected for Beijing. And so one would be that Trump has shown himself to be very susceptible to personal diplomacy, right? In kind of earlier in his administration, I think this was 2017, 2018, he announced bans on ZTE and Huawei. And through personal diplomacy, Xi Jinping was able to kind of get both of those rolled back, right? And I think you can see kind of another example of this in Trump's relationship with Vladimir Putin, right? There's clearly a strong personal affinity there. And I think it's perfectly reasonable to imagine Xi Jinping taking a similar tack and kind of playing up on their personal rapport to then get Trump to reduce economic pressure on China, to kind of play to his desire to be seen as a deal maker, right? So that's one element. And also, we kind of already alluded to this, but the fact that Trump is an America first foreign policy, that is his preference, that could really loosen the partnerships that the U.S. has, which are also giving China grief. And if the U.S. is seen as an unreliable security partner, well, that's the sort of incentive that might prompt, the EU or Japan or Korea or whoever else to then seek a more productive working relationship with China and not just kind of hew to the U.S. line. So pros and cons. I don't think that China necessarily sees one as better than the other, but offering kind of different challenges and opportunities.
These are the times leading up to these, the predictable tumultuousness of what is going to happen. I mean, and they typically come out of the gates hot once they win, because they've got years to undo, roll back, and walk back things that they, they'll come out of the, they come out firing with some disregard, because they've got time to work on the collateral damage if there is some. So I think what that does, though, is it puts foreign companies potentially on edge, because they're not 100% sure what to expect. And so can I ask you, maybe what can foreign companies expect in the next year or two? And how can they potentially insulate themselves from any geopolitical risk either way?
I'll just start by saying that geopolitical risk, especially with regard to doing business in China, has increased just exponentially in recent years. And so, obviously, kind of on the face of it, that's bad news for multinationals, right? And it makes just for a much more kind of complicated business environment where you really have to mind your P's and Q's in a way that maybe you didn't before. But I would say that there are steps that companies can take to really kind of protect themselves. So in terms of what to expect, first of all, yeah, the U.S.-China tension is not going anywhere, right? I think no matter who's in office, we're going to see an expansion of tariffs. One thing to keep in mind is that, so far, China has been relatively circumspect about not responding in kind with tariffs, right? That it's sort of basically the MO has been to, for the most part, just kind of rant and rail about American protectionism and economic suppression, but then either opt to not do anything or to do a mostly symbolic response. However, I that could certainly change, right? China has been building out its counter sanctions and counter economic coercion legal toolbox, right? So it is expanding its legal basis to be able to strike back against that. And for right now, I think the preference on the Chinese side is not to escalate tensions where they don't have to, not to make life any harder for foreign firms in China by proactively, striking, or rather reactively striking back against U.S. sanctions. That could change, right? There could come a point where the calculus changes and the folks in Zhongnanhai say, well, you know what? Like, we've tried playing nice. We've tried trying to ignore it. And now the time has come to fight back. Right. So that's an eventuality that I think that that companies need to be prepared for. I would just also say that it's really critical to, this is sort of a cop-out answer, but to expect the unexpected, right? If you had, you know, asked somebody in 2021 what the main geopolitical challenges in the world would be in the coming 2 years, probably, I don't think many people would have said there's going to be a massive crisis between Russia and Ukraine that also in turn kind of pits, you know, the two halves of the world against each other, right? You know, you might have said generally, oh, conflict in the Middle East will be something to watch. But the specifics of just how serious things have gotten in that part of the world in recent months, I don't think that that a lot of people would necessarily have predicted. So that's so much to say that you need to be nimble enough to respond to changing circumstances and kind of differentiate between the known unknowns and the unknown unknowns, right? To acknowledge that things are going to happen in the geopolitical risk space that you can't necessarily foresee right now, right? So I think a strong strategy for dealing with geopolitical risk would to be have really, really good contingency planning, to conduct internal stress tests, you know, in different scenarios, to be really aware of your industry and to what extent it is a hot button issue or might become a hot button issue, and whether it's likely to face pressure from you know, any of the main markets that you operate in. And also, I would say coordination across geographies, right? So the folks who live and work in China are kind of very well acquainted with the specific risks related to doing business with China and China's relationship with other countries. But, you know, those people's colleagues in the US or Europe or Canada or where else, they're not necessarily going to be thinking about that day by day. So I think it's really important that, you know, and this is not just a one-way street, is I think that the geopolitical risk needs to be looked at holistically and communicated effectively between different parts of your organization to really be effective. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's just sort of, it's very much kind of that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, and just really being aware of trends and where they're leading.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken recently visited China. Were there any positives that we could take out of that, especially with regards to the trade relationship that we could take out of that visit?
Yeah, I think in some ways that was a more productive meeting than a lot of us predicted, or more productive trip. You know, he met with Wang Yi, the foreign minister, and that was kind of a more traditional, you know, full and frank exchange of views and quite a lot of you know, kind of crosstalk about issues where they disagree. But Blinken also met with Xi Jinping, and to kind of look at the readout from that meeting, she made a comment that was something like, oh, let's handle the first principles well, and all the other stuff will fall into line. And that kind of, to me and my team, that kind of seemed like maybe a tacit acknowledgement that, yeah, we understand there are going to be bumps along the road, especially in an election year in the U.S., but we're taking the long view of U.S.-China relations. And, you know, I don't think that there's, you know, it's things are never going to go back to the way they were in, you know, 2010, 2012. But I think that Xi Jinping and a number of other leaders in China kind of see this as a rebalancing of U.S.-China relations, where it's not necessarily going to be defined by conflict, but there is going to just be kind of longstanding geopolitical competition. And the challenge will be to find the acceptable limits of that competition, right? What's within the realm of reasonable competition and what is too much? So, you know, who knows to what extent that message, you know, we interpreted that message correctly, and who knows to what extent that represents Xi Jinping's real thinking. But I think that there's a pretty good case for you know, saying that that Blinken visit kind of showed that there is still an appetite on both sides for dialogue and for building a relationship which can withstand shocks and disagreements without falling apart completely.
Now, following on that, what factors could you maybe point to for us that you think may have been holding back China's economic recovery coming out of the pandemic? And I know there's a very large assumption built into that question. Mm-hmm. So correct me if I'm wrong, assuming that there has been. And then any positive indicators on the horizon?
Yeah. So no, I mean, certainly the recovery has not materialized the way that most businesses have hoped, and indeed not the way that Chinese policymakers would have hoped. And that comes down first and foremost to demand is still very depressed post-pandemic, right? People are just not confident in their consumption. The instinct after kind of a traumatic shock like COVID, which was incredibly, you know, dislocating economically speaking, is to save. Right. I mean, Chinese households, even prior to the pandemic, had a reputation for saving a lot more than in the West. And that instinct has just kind of been, you know, the experience of COVID just made that instinct even stronger. And so that creates a number of problems, right? Is people aren't spending, you know, demand is depressed. It's small and medium-sized enterprises, which were the ones that were most affected by COVID, also account for a disproportionate amount of China's employment, which, you know, it kind of creates a vicious cycle then, right? People are unemployed or underemployed, so they don't feel confident, so they don't spend, so people don't want to hire, right? Housing is another one, right? Is that the housing market being depressed? That for a long time, housing was kind of the store of wealth and the investment that you could make as an average person in China that would, secure your future. But that's sort of no longer the case. People are very concerned about whether or not that's still a good investment or as good an investment as it was in the past. And in many cases, they've judged no, right? And so when you have kind of these two factors, playing off one against each other, and at the same time, you have all this industrial capacity, which is not getting absorbed by the domestic market, whether that's, you know, building materials for housing or consumer goods that people simply aren't buying, you know, that contributes to the overcapacity issue. And so all these issues are interrelated. I don't want to oversell the doom and gloom message. The real GDP print from Q1 was 5.3. I think 5.3%. I think that leaders are probably reasonably happy with that. So it's not a terrible, terrible picture, but it's sort of this persistent demand issue that they don't seem to really have a solution for. So we'll be watching the third plenum in July to see if they roll out any kind of reforms that indicate a change of tack. So yeah, that's what we're looking for. And, for the time being, it might just be a rough economic outlook for some time before things begin to improve.
Let's give you a bit of a platform to talk more about Trivium China. And tell us a little bit more about Trivium China and tell us a little bit more about where we can maybe follow some of your writing and research.
Absolutely. So Trivium China is a small consultancy that's completely China focused. Founded in 2017. So we're a relatively young company. Basically, what we tell people, which is true, is that we spend all day reading Chinese policy documents so you don't have to, right? We have an open source research methodology, which is based on, you know, gleaning the insights sort of directly from the horse's mouth. We try to present it in ways that are easy to follow and without, spin, presenting it things as objectively as possible. We kind of originally got well known for our series of newsletters, which cover topics ranging from politics to finance to tech to net zero. And that's probably the best way to sort of keep track of what we're doing on a day-to-day basis. We have a free daily newsletter. We also have paid daily newsletters, which are much more in-depth. And that kind of presents our up-to-the-minute thinking on developments as they happen. I'll also plug, as earlier I said, probably the best way for MNCs to insulate themselves against geopolitical risk would be to conduct stress tests and determine what exposure their industry has to the prevailing geopolitical winds. That's something that we very much do. We do bespoke work, on a client by client and industry by industry basis. If you have any questions about, preventing or insulating yourself from risk in the China market, looking for new opportunities, or really just kind of understanding the state of play, the landscape, the market or geopolitical landscape, the stakeholders who are making decisions, then drop us a line. We're happy to hear from anybody and everybody, and we'll see if there's ways for us to cooperate. But yeah, that's us. We're basically policy nerds who have tried to monetize our nerdiness.
I think that for any MNCs who want to try to insulate themselves against geopolitical risk, the first thing they should do is probably listen to this podcast.
Yeah, I agree. Absolutely.
The second thing they should do is get in touch with Trivium and follow everything that Joe Mazur does. And then third, some stress tests and all that other mumbo jumbo you said. But anyway, Joe Mazur, senior analyst at Trivium China. Thanks very much, man. Really appreciate you coming on the show. We'll definitely try to get you back on again soon.
Thanks a bunch, Todd. I really enjoyed it. See you soon.
Okay. As usual, for everybody listening to the audio only, don't forget to head over to the WPIC YouTube channel. Catch up on some shorts and some other information and tidbits over there. For those of you watching on YouTube, don't forget, if you need your eyes and ears for other things and you're in your car or something like that, you need to drive, don't forget we have the audio only version anywhere you get your podcasts, including Spotify or Apple Podcasts or anywhere like that. But for me and for Joe and for everybody at the WPIC and the negotiation team, thanks very much for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Growing a company is hard. Doing it in a foreign market, exponentially so. The best piece of advice I can give you is not to do it alone. When you start looking at the Asia-Pacific region for further expansion possibilities, and I sincerely hope you do, make sure you choose the right partners to do it with. My good friends at WPIC Marketing and Technologies have almost 20 years of experience helping brands, just like yours, enter China, Japan, and Southeast Asia. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Negotiation, and if you're interested in being a guest or want to connect with me or any of our team, please reach out to us at podcast@wpic.co, and be sure to rate, comment, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.